Hello, welcome to episode 2 of Basic Structure, your friendly guide to the Indian Constitution. My name is Soumya Rao and I'm pretty excited to bring this episode to you because it talks about the birth of our nation and the transfer of power. Let's get started. In the last episode, I had told you that Nehru had submitted a particular resolution to the Constituent Assembly and he wanted all of the members to deeply engage with it and adopt this resolution. Why? Because in that document, he summarized the hopes and aspirations of an entire nation and wrote out what he thought our country would have wanted in our constitution. So this is how the resolution begins. Quote, "This Constituent Assembly declares its firm and solemn resolve to proclaim India as an independent, sovereign republic and to draw up for her future governance a constitution." End quote. Through these words, Nehru was making the intentions of the Constituent Assembly pretty clear, that the Assembly was here to draw up the roadmap for an independent nation, one that was sovereign in its own right, which meant that it had the own right to decide how to govern itself, and a nation that was a republic, wherein all power was concentrated in the people, and not in, say, a monarchy, not in the kings and queens, or not in just a small select group of people. And this was important to set out right at the beginning because these concepts will go on to define how our Constituent Assembly would think about the various rights and obligations that the people of the country enjoyed. To my mind, however, these words weren't the most important part of the resolution. What was really striking for me was a later part of the resolution, which goes as follows, open quotes, "wherein shall be guaranteed and secured to all the people of India justice, social, economic, and political, equality of status, of opportunity, and before the law, freedom of thought, expression, belief, faith, worship, vocation, association, and action, subject to law and public morality." To me, these parts of the resolution are really important because they set out the rights and the duties that the people of the country are going to enjoy, right? Which is that we're going to have justice of all forms, not just economic justice or political justice, but social justice as well. That we will not only enjoy equality of status and opportunity, but we will also be treated equally by the law. That we will have the freedom of thought, worship, work, association, belief, and action. However, that it will broadly be subject to the greater restraints of law and public morality. This sets out a really vast and admiring vision for how a set of people decided that the future generations of their country should live in the freest, most egalitarian sense possible. And I've only read out some parts of the resolution here, but I encourage you to read it in its entirety to fully understand its spirit, right? In fact, I would also strongly recommend reading Nehru's speech that day. Not for any partisan reason, but to me, his speech was the stuff of dreams. It's the speech of a man who has worked with his colleagues to achieve the fullest measure of freedom for his country and is now in a position, a very enviable position, to be able to shape that freedom towards an ideal society as his colleagues and he see it. The speech is poetic for sure and well-drafted, as most of Nehru's speeches are. But it's also clear-eyed, honest about the challenges that will face our country, and it fills me with humility. Between this day, when the resolution was introduced, and the 22nd of January 1947, the Constituent Assembly, as wished by Nehru, discussed the resolution in great detail. In doing so, they touched upon some fairly trivial issues and some not so trivial issues, such as, the absence of the Muslim League members, whether they should even be discussing such important ideas when the entire assembly was not present. They discussed whether we should invoke the name of God in this resolution. And most importantly, they discussed whether the princely states would be okay with such a strong assertion of republicanism and sovereignty, you know, as opposed to, say, recognizing the sovereignty of the kings and the nizams of the princely states. In response to one such question raised during the discussion on the resolution, Nehru very strongly said, "The idea of the sovereignty of the people, which is enshrined in this resolution, does not commend itself to certain rulers of Indian states. It is a scandalous thing for any man to say, however highly placed he may be, that he is here by special divine dispensation to rule over human beings today. That is a thing which is an intolerable presumption on any man's part, and it is a thing which this house will never allow and will repudiate if it is put before it. We have heard a lot about this divine right of kings. We have read a lot about it in past histories, and we had thought that we had heard the last of it, and that it had been put an end to and buried deep into the earth long ages ago. If any individual in India or elsewhere raises it today, he would be doing so without any relation to the present in India. So I would suggest to such persons, in all seriousness, that if they want to be respected or considered with any measure of friendliness, no such idea should even be hinted at, much less said. On this, there is going to be no compromise. With these words, I think Nehru very clearly laid out the republican foundations of our country. By republican, I mean the republic-like foundations of our country. And as he and the other members of the House debated various other issues, it was time for his closing speech on the resolution. So gathering together all of the objections and the agreements in his speech, he made a few remarks, and this is my favorite part here, and I'm going to read it out to you. Open quotes. "It was a great responsibility to be trustees of the future, and it was some responsibility also to be inheritors of the great past of ours. And between that great past and the great future which we envisage, we stood on the edge of the present, and the weight of that occasion, I have no doubt, impressed itself upon this honorable house." So saying, he addressed the last of the concerns and questions that the members had about the resolution, and then submitted it to be voted upon and adopted. Now, this resolution was unanimously adopted by the Constituent Assembly on the 22nd of January 1947, and it was the seed that grew into the Constitution. With the adoption of this resolution, called the Objectives Resolution, the members had a clear sense of the work that lay before them and the direction in which they wanted the country to move. The Assembly then went about its task of forming various committees and figuring out the process of drafting the Constitution, the formalities, the logistics, and so on. Alongside the painful political discussions about partition, about the manner in which independence would take place, and so on, were also happening. And from January to July to August, these discussions continued. And late in the evening of 14th August 1947, the Assembly met in the Constitution Hall. Remember, I told you about the Constitution Hall in the last episode. And at the stroke of midnight, when India became independent, the Constituent Assembly took over as the Legislative Assembly of an independent India. On the 29th of August 1947, the Constituent Assembly set up a drafting committee under the chairmanship of Dr. B.R. Ambedkar to start preparing the actual text of the draft Constitution of India. And with that, the Constituent Assembly actually began its core work of writing the Constitution. And the debates they had during the course of these months are historic. They give you great insight into what our founding fathers and founding mothers wanted the country to be. But most importantly, they tell you how hopeful our founding fathers and mothers were. While deliberating upon the draft constitution, the Assembly moved and discussed about 2,473 amendments. They discussed these out of a total of 7,635 amendments that were actually tabled. After all the amendments were adopted and the constitution had gone through numerous readings, it was adopted on 26th of November 1949. Members signed a handwritten calligraphed copy of the Constitution on the 24th of January 1950. In all, 284 members signed the Constitution. And the Constitution of India actually came into force on the 26th of January 1950, or what we now call Republic Day.
Well, and from this, the 26th day of January 1950, India, that is Bharat, shall be a sovereign democratic republic, and the union and its component parts, the states, shall exercise all powers and functions of government and administration in accordance with the provisions of the said constitution.
On that day, the Constituent Assembly ceased to exist and transformed itself into the Provisional Parliament of India, to be functioning until a new parliament was constituted in 1952. But before that, it's time for a fun fact as we say goodbye to the Constituent Assembly debates. Why is August 15th our Independence Day? Do you know? Here's the story. So Lord Mountbatten, who was the last Viceroy of India and the first Governor General of Independent India, was at the time managing the handover of sovereignty to the Indian peoples. So he decided to advance the date of Indian and Pakistani independence because he considered the 15th of August to be very lucky. During World War II, it was on the 15th of August 1945 in Japan's time zone that the Japanese army had surrendered. And at the time, Lord Mountbatten was the supreme allied commander for Southeast Asia. And Lord Mountbatten also mentions this in his congratulatory address to the Indian people on 15th August 1947, where he says, "In fact, it was on this very day 2 years ago that I was with that great friend of India, Mr. Clement Attlee, in his cabinet room when the news came through that Japan had surrendered. And because he had fond memories of that day, he decided that it would be great to tie in India's destiny with that of 15th August 1947, and that's why that particular date was chosen as our Independence Day. I hope you enjoyed that fun fact. And with that, we're going to answer a really interesting but also quite a technical question, and the kind of question that will actually get lawyers and constitutional theorists very excited. What happened between August 15th, 1947 and Jan 26th, 1950? So thanks to Lord Mountbatten, August 15th is known as our Independence Day. But what does this actually mean? What happened on Independence Day? Who transferred power and to whom? To answer this question, let's think of a cricket field in which there's a fielder at the boundary, there's one in the midfield, there's a wicketkeeper and a bowler. These are our four key characters, okay? Now, say the batsman hits the ball towards the boundary fielder stops it, picks it up, throws it to the midfield person, who throws it to the wicketkeeper, who throws it back to the bowler. Think of this ball as sovereignty. What's sovereignty? It's a word that means the ability to rule or govern something with supreme power and authority, and all countries have sovereignty. So when this boundary fielder picks up the ball, he or she is playing the role of something called the Government of India Act. Until 15th August 1947, we were governed by the Government of India Act 1935. This act was kind of like a constitution for India pre-independence. It was an act which was passed by British Parliament. So when I say act here, I mean law or legislation. And every other law or legislation that governed India pre-independence drew its power from the Government of India Act. So for example, say you murdered someone in 1942. You would be punished under the Indian Penal Code, 1860, and this law would draw its legitimacy from the Government of India Act. At this point, you're probably thinking, but the British have been in India for a long time, and this act is from 1935. What happened before 1935? That's a good question. We've had many Government of India Acts, and the British Parliament would keep repealing them ever so often and making a new one as required. The 1935 Act was the most recent one. So when the boundary fielder is holding the ball, that is the role of the Government of India Act. And on the stroke of midnight, when it became 15th of August 1947, the boundary fielder passes the ball to the midfielder, and thus sovereignty also passes, and India and Pakistan both become dominions. This transfer of sovereignty is done through something called the Indian Independence Act 1947. This was also a law passed by British Parliament, and through this law, two dominions called India and Pakistan were created, and the law empowered them to go about the business of becoming actual countries with sovereignty. A good question to ask at this point is, what is a dominion? How is it different from being ruled by the British? So a dominion is an independently governed country, but one which still owes some measure of allegiance to another authority. So in this case, the other authority would be the King of England. Remember I told you previously that Mountbatten just picked 15th August out of the air? The original date of our independence was supposed to be sometime in June 1948. So until June 1948, King George was still referred to as the Emperor of India. It was only from 22nd June 1948 onwards, according to the London Gazette, that the Crown omitted using Emperor of India as part of his title. So there you go, that's a bonus fun fact. But moving back to our cricket field analogy, so where are we now? The midfielder is holding the ball. The ball is the transfer of sovereignty according to the Indian Independence Act, and India is a dominion. Now, at some point, the midfielder throws the ball to the wicketkeeper. And this act is basically the dominion of India drafting and adopting its constitution and ensuring that we, the people, now have sovereignty. Once the wicketkeeper is holding the ball, which is basically post-Republic Day, India has become a sovereign democratic republic, and the people are the masters of their own fate. Now, with this, most of us would have been quite happy with these chain of events, but not the drafters of the constitution. At this point, a doubt arose in their minds about whether Indians could truly claim they were sovereign if the basis for the Constituent Assembly and our independence and all of that came about through British laws, the Government of India Act and the Indian Independence Act. So it's a good question, right? Therefore, to ensure that there was no doubt whatsoever about the effect or the impact of these two British laws upon the status of sovereignty of India, the Constitution, through something called Article 395, repealed these acts. And it basically said these acts will have no effect from this time onwards. Again, most of us would have been happy with these extra precautions. But is there anyone who's thinking what the lawyers in the room are probably thinking? Which is that if these two acts are British laws passed by British Parliament, how can the Indian Constitution outlaw them? Or to think of it another way, if, say, Donald Trump and the American Congress and the American Senate tomorrow pass a law which says all Indian H-1B visa holders should immediately return to India and can't stay in the US any longer, can our constitution be amended to say that law will have no impact? No, right? So how can the Indian Constitution then overrule the Government of India Act and the Indian Independence Act, which are British laws? It's a great answer, actually. And according to some legal scholars, this was done to ensure something called constitutional autochthony. That's a weird word, so I'm going to spell it. It's A-U-T-O-C-H-T-H-O-N-Y, autochthony. Or in other words, the delivering of an indigenous constitution, the source of whose authority is located in the new country's own soil. Now, in a wonderful article by Shivprasad Swaminathan on this particular subject, the author says, "The Constitution of India repealed the Indian Independence Act, something that they did not have the authorization to do. In doing so, the framers not only repudiated the source which authorized them to enact the Constitution, but it was also a denial, although a symbolic denial, of Indian independence being a grant of the Imperial Crown in Parliament. This ensured that the chain of constitutional validity did not extend all the way to the Crown and Parliament and thus delivered to the people of India a completely autochthonous constitution." So through this web of legal strictures and some cricket, we the people attained the right to rule over ourselves and became masters of our own fate. Now, interestingly, the Government of India Act was repealed by the British Parliament in 1998, and the Indian Independence Act continues to exist even today as a British law. That's pretty weird, right? And you can take that as your third piece of trivia from today's podcast episode, but I also have a really interesting fun fact to tell you. When the Constitution was actually being signed, it was drizzling outside. And a lot of commentators who write about the day when the Constitution was signed note that this was seen as a good omen by a lot of the members of the Assembly. And speaking of good omens and good luck and, you know, the actual working of the Constitution, it's important to note what Dr. Ambedkar said when the Constitution was adopted. So he says, open quotes, the working of a constitution does not depend wholly upon the nature of the constitution, but on the people and the political parties they will set up as their instruments to carry out their wishes and their politics. And it's been 68 plus years now since the constitution came into being. What does its report card look like? But more importantly, what does our report card look like as the electorate? Should you and I still be as hopeful as the founding fathers and mothers were? And have the politicians that we've elected always promoted the values of the constitution? To ask another even more blunt question, what are the core values of the constitution? Is there something called the basic structure of the constitution? These and many more interesting questions in our next episode, in which we will also start reading the constitution, beginning with the preamble. Let me know what you thought of this episode and do tune in for the next one. Thanks for listening. From the last episode, some of you had asked that I reduce the length of this podcast and that I try to use more sound effects to make it fun to listen to. I'm still trying to figure this out, so give me a few more episodes before I start getting the hang of editing for brevity and editing for interest. And if you have any other feedback on this one as well, please do let me know. I look forward to hearing from you, especially if you have any issues on the topics we've discussed so far, or more interestingly, if you have any questions about the preamble, which we will be talking about shortly. You can send me an email at basicstructurepodcast@gmail.com. You can tweet to me at basic_structure. The text of the podcast is up on my blog, www.sowmya.co. And you can find me on Twitter at sowmyarao_. All right, enjoy the rest of your weekend. See you next Sunday, armed with the preamble. Bye.